The final case set for oral argument this morning is Megabe Alley versus Darren Young. Matthew Templer appears on behalf of the appellant, Darren Young, and Mark Cady appears on behalf of the appellee, Mr. Alley. You're on the unusual appellee side, Mr. Cady. All right, with that, then, Mr. Templer, you may proceed with your 15-minute oral argument.
May it please the court. This case boils down to one word: ignored. The habeas court ignored the law, it ignored the evidence, and it ignored its own reasoning to grant Alley habeas. Respondent respectfully requests that this court reverse the habeas court's determinations that Alley received ineffective assistance of counsel and that it reinstate his manslaughter convictions. Because this is an ineffective assistance case, everything must be viewed from the defense counsel's perspective at the time. So what did Tracy Smith and Kenny Jacobs know? They knew that MK suffered a massive skull fracture and resultant brain injuries. They knew the state's theory was that Alley inflicted multiple impacts to MK's head. They knew that Alley consistently claimed that MK's death was an accident and that he must have fallen out of bed. They knew the police didn't believe this story, and they knew that their own experts would testify that it was possible that an accidental fall caused the skull fracture, but they were unwilling to testify it was probable, and they were unwilling to rule out homicide as the manner of death. Armed with this information, Smith and Jacobs presented an accident theory of defense because they believed that Dr. Snell, the state's medical examiner, was wrong to label MK's death a homicide. They presented this theory to the jury by relying on Alley as their main witness, letting him tell his side of things, and explain his claim that he found MK propped up against the bed. They also used the testimony of Dr. Ockhoven and Dr. Van Yee to try to build up Alley's credibility and build up the credibility of his accident claim by showing that the science said it was possible. And then they also gained helpful concessions from some of the state's witnesses. Now, ultimately, the question in this case becomes, were Smith and Jacobs' actions objectively reasonable, or did actions that no competent attorney would, and thereby caused a breakdown in the adversarial process and denied Alley a right to a fair trial? Simply put, their actions were reasonable, and Alley received a fair trial. Now, under the Strickland analysis, both prongs have to be proven. So this court can start with either the deficient performance analysis or the prejudice analysis. And when discussing the opening statement issue and the closing statement slash discovery issue, I think it's best to start with this prong. The jury was correctly and repeatedly instructed that the state had the burden of proof to prove Alley's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. They were repeatedly instructed that the arguments and statements of counsel were not evidence, and they were instructed that they could base their verdict only on the evidence presented. We have to presume that the jury followed these instructions. That presumption negates any prejudice that Judge Hoffman found based on these opening statements and the closing argument. Likewise, the prejudice analysis that he engaged in was incorrect because for the opening statement, he had to isolate a single sentence from an 8-day jury trial transcript. And as well, for the closing, he had to isolate a short portion from that 8-day transcript. Now, likewise, even when you look at the information presented for the opening statement, Mr. Jacobs' opening statement tracked what the defense was, that this was in fact an accident, not that it was just possible. And Tracy Smith even testified during the habeas hearing that it would have undermined the defense's credibility and Alley's credibility had Mr. Jacobs said, well, an accidental fall is possible, because they had to plant the seed early in the jurors' minds that this was in fact an accident, because they had to overcome the strong evidence of the multiple impacts that Dr. Snell found on MK's head.
Can you address, counsel, what, you know, one of the significant determinations made by the habeas court appeared to be the defense expert witness, Dr. Ockhoven, and the failure to keep her around for potential SIR rebuttal. What, in your view, makes that determination erroneous?
So that determination is erroneous because we have to look at, in ineffective assistance analysis, that trial counsel is presumed to have made every decision in furtherance of a reasonable strategic decision. But we don't have to just rely on that presumption here. Tracy Smith testified at the habeas hearing that she didn't recall Dr. Opphoven because she believed she got all the helpful information that she needed from her, and that you're always running a risk having to recall an expert, because while even though they may be your witness, there's a chance that they might blurt out something that's harmful to your case. Likewise, in her 16 years of experience, she testified that it doesn't play well with juries to plow the same ground with experts that will never agree. So she made the strategic decision there, and by Judge Hoffman finding that to be ineffective, he's actually taking the strategic decision out of counsel's hands, which goes directly against what we stand for when it comes to presenting a defense and allowing wide latitude for defense counsel in making their decisions. Likewise, even if, or the fact that they didn't recall her, it doesn't change anything, because she was allowed to testify in front of the jury on direct and cross, presenting her alternate theory of what happened to MK and explaining the multiple hemorrhages around his scalp. So she still was able to present that, even though she wasn't recalled. And Justice Kennedy, in Harrington versus Richter, said Strickland doesn't create Newton's third law of expert witnesses, that for every state expert, there must be an equal and opposite defense expert. So there it was again, shows it was up to Smith's strategic decision of whether to recall Dr. Opphoven.
Mr. Templar, you said, though, that it was a strategic decision, but wasn't there testimony at the habeas that she just felt that she wasn't available and so wouldn't be able to call her? And Dr. Opphoven contradicted that by telling us that had she been asked, she would have made herself available.
So 2 points on that, Your Honor. Yes, she was unavailable to testify beyond just the day that she did testify. The strategic decision goes to Smith not recalling her in the redirect, which Judge Hoffman found an issue with, but then the fact that she was unavailable goes to not recalling her on SIR rebuttal, and that's also where that quote from Harrington versus Richter goes. And also the fact that Dr. Opphoven testified at the habeas hearing 6 years later that she would have been available, that's using hindsight. Hindsight's 20/20, and this court has already instructed that you can't use hindsight to Monday morning quarterback the decisions of trial counsel and what they did at trial. Likewise, contrary to Judge Coughlin's determinations, Dr. Opphoven wasn't the key expert for the defense. Ms. Smith testified that it was actually Dr. Danny who was the key expert because he was there to testify about the physics and whether that the physics lined up with supporting Allie's accident story. Dr. Opphoven was the one that they suggested they hire Dr. Danny, and without his opinion, she couldn't have presented her opinion that she couldn't rule out accident as the manner of death. So ultimately, it came down to whether the jury believed Dr. Danny, that MK fell and hit his head on the bed rail, or they believed Dr. Snow, that Allie inflicted multiple impacts to MK's head. We have to rely on the juries to make these determinations because it deals with conflicting evidence, and they have to weigh that evidence and reach their decision. And that can't be second-guessed by the courts now in the habeas action.
Counsel, one of the allegations of error is that the defense failed to play the videos of Ellie's interrogation with Detective Sarda in their entirety. Can you address that?
Sure. So again, it was a strategy decision. Smith said during the criminal trial itself, when then-Judge Salter asked her after they filed the motion to suppress, well, do you really want to keep these out? There's some exculpatory information in there. And she said yes, because if we play those, the state's going to use it to make out that there's inconsistencies, and it's another person with a badge and a gun interviewing our client, and then it's also allowed, it would also attack the credibility of Allie himself, because with him being their main witness, they had to build up his credibility. But throughout those interviews, Detective Sardar repeatedly states he doesn't believe Ali that it was an accident. He even goes so far as saying it's not possible, which would directly contradict Dr. Ockhoven and Dr. Manny.
What in those videos would have been, could have been used to attack his credibility?
So I think while it's true that Judge Salter gave a limiting instruction that the jury couldn't rely on Detective Sardar's statements in the video as evidence, it would still potentially plant a seed in the jurors' minds to not believe Ali and his accident.
I was wondering if there's anything that Ali actually said, but when you say attack this credibility, you're referring to those law enforcement statements.
Right, because Ali consistently said this was an accident. He rejected Detective Sardar's alternate explanations of what happened to MK such that he was frustrated with him and took the frustration out on him, or that they happened to be playing and he hit his head as they were playing. He consistently rejected all of those. He consistently said, I don't know what happened, other than it must have been an accident. He must have fell out of bed.
Am I correct in my understanding that there were three interviews, December 24, December 26, and December 27, and that in Exhibit 15, the December 26 interview was played in its entirety, with the exception of the times in which Ellie was alone?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the jury saw over an hour of actual interviews, the December 26 interview basically in its entirety.
Yes, Your Honor. For all intents and purposes, it was the full interview. It was just for lack of a better term, the dead time of just Ali sitting in the room. That video, I believe, was 2.5 hours approximately. The first video was about 54 minutes, and I believe about a half hour of that was just Ali sitting in the room by himself. And then the third interview, after he'd been arrested, it was again about 2.5 hours, and there was over an hour just sitting there by himself. So those portions of videos are routinely edited out for time when there's nothing going on. I think it would be a closer call had there been, perhaps he's talking to himself while he's in there, but he's just sitting there. So it wouldn't have had any effect on the outcome of the case had they played these long videos, including the time that he was sitting there. And so that's part of the issue with Judge Hoffman saying they should have played the entire videos, when it's cumulative. They already heard from Ali himself in his own testimony. They saw Exhibit 15. And then they heard the concessions from Detective Sardar that Ali consistently denied hurting MK, and then Ali rejected all the alternate theories. So there's no reasonable probability that had they played these videos, the outcome would have been different in a sense that it would have turned into a favorable acquittal for Ali on all charges. It actually could have backfired. Because, like I said, they had to build up Ali's credibility. And that actually would undercut it if you're presenting evidence that potentially negates what he's saying. And I think that ultimately would be like the Dillon versus Weber case, where this court did find there was ineffective assistance, because essentially Dillon's attorney failed to present a defense, and he even went so far as proving the state's case when he was asking questions on cross-examination that proved to the rape charge. That's not what happened here. Smith and Jacobs put up every roadblock they could to the state's case, and they defended Ali to the best of their ability. But they were ultimately stuck with the science behind this that it was only possible. And then they also had Dr. Van E testify across examination that while shortfalls can be fatal, they're extremely rare. And so they were fighting an uphill battle. And one of the things, too, when it comes to the videos, it's a reasonable strategic decision to not play them. As I cited the Irvin case in my brief, there the Eighth Circuit found that Irvin couldn't show ineffective assistance when his attorney decided to rely on witness testimony for impeachment rather than playing his co-defendant's guilty plea video, where he exonerates Irvin, but then he says in the trial testimony that it was Irvin and him that committed the murders. So there's precedent right there to show it is reasonable. And we always have to remember that it's fine that Judge Hoffman would have tried the case one way, and it's fine that Smith and Jacobs would try it the other way, because no two attorneys try a case the same way. And that's why we have to rely on trial counsel's decisions and give them the benefit of the doubt and the presumption that they made strategic decisions. There are no further questions from the court. We respectfully ask
Thank you, Mr. Templer.
Chief, before we proceed, can we make sure that the microphone is on for IT? There should be a green light on in the room back there.
I want him to do it.
All right, you may proceed, Mr. Cady.
Is there a clock counter in this room? Yeah, okay, thank you.
Before I get into what I was prepared to talk about, I would like to counter a couple of issues that were brought up. I think this court in the briefs and currently is being bombarded with truisms. Look, when we're talking about hindsight, what testimony isn't hindsight? Someone is getting up on the witness stand to talk about things that happened in the past. Hindsight is involved in this. And that's a rule that comes out in terms of when decisions are decided, we can't just look back on hindsight. But the facts of the case are someone's testifying about what they remember, and that can be judged. Now, opposing counsel mentioned how Smith had a strategy and she didn't need to call Op Hoven back. And she testifies about that initially, but her testimony has some transitions in it. For instance, when asked, this would be in the fourth habeas volume, page 114, would Dr. Ophoven had been in a better position to warn you of any inconsistencies in Dr. Snell's opinions if she had been, in fact, been asked to stay one more day to see rebuttal testimony on February 26th? Smith says possibly, and then she says probably. So yes, there's some answers that refute that, but this is what comes later in the hearing. She admits that it would have been useful for that purpose. Also,
counsel, what about the state's point in her other testimony about a strategic concern about how at trial ultimately the sur rebuttal testimony of the expert would have went, because it's not just a matter of saying, well, she had this additional great point that maybe could have been made in rebuttal. She also would have been crossed on whatever she said. And in the realities, we don't really ultimately know how that would have turned out, do we? And is that a strategic concern by an attorney when you think the way it stands, the way my record currently stands, I have good arguments I can make, and is there a problem that might undermine what's already in the record?
Habeas hearings are designed to look back and to see if things were done right. That's what the function of those hearings are. And I recall in terms of people being able to see the quality of Dr. Ophoven's testimony, Judge Hoffman made a comment about how he thought she was the best expert he'd ever seen. So that's an example of how good she is. And then when you look at...
of course, the habeas court didn't get the opportunity to see the state's experts at trial. So it's not really a fair comparison, is it?
No, I think it is, because that's what the function of the court is to do, look at the transcript, and even through a transcript, can you see problems that are there? And other things about the transition of Smith's testimony, she initially had thought that the McVeigh case, a capital case that was set to go 3 or 4 weeks after the Ali case, she initially thought it didn't have that much of an effect. But later, by a question from state's counsel, did that case at all affect your ability to defend Mr. Ali or affect your performance in this trial at all? And she said, it would. I think that is a question that the court is going to have to decide. And the habeas court did decide. And we're in a situation where the standards of review are such that you need to look at whether or not the findings are clearly wrong. Is there something that suggests you that a mistake was made by Judge Hoffman about these findings? I don't think there is. That he made a mistake in light of the testimony that was there at the habeas hearing and reading the transcript? With that, the idea that you weren't there to see a testimony, that affects every case that this court looks at.
And I've been reviewing the findings that Judge Hoffman made, and I'm not seeing a lot in those findings with regard to any determinations With regard to determinations about whether the strategic reasons that counsel did provide, instead it appears to be a lot of pointing out these were errors without reference back to whether the strategic reasons why they did or didn't do something were reasonable.
The findings discussed with regards to Dr. Oppoven and also referring back to the areas in the transcripts, that there were not enough distinctions made between impacts that happened to the child and that caused the death of this child. There are impacts, signs of bruising and things of that had nothing to do with any kind of injury sustained that day, but are nevertheless there. And this habeas court, I think, in its findings and in its discussion during the case, had stated that when you have testimony blurring between impact of significance and just any impact, it's difficult to differentiate what everyone is talking about. And the habeas court made a couple of comments like that in the transcripts about that. Questions were being asked in a succinct way to finally put the points across. And so when you have someone, the trial counsel said that she didn't really understand the significance of dealing with a major impact versus other impacts. But that's the whole thing. That's the whole theory, because the defense theory was one blow to the head, and the rest of all these kinds of signs of injury were really just a lot of the inability of blood to clot, the impact of transfusions and things of that nature, making signs that might suggest it was a multi-major impact happening, but it really was just one injury and then a reaction to it. And that needed to be explained better, and that's what the court was talking about, and that's what you see when you read some of the transcripts. For instance, on the Oppoven transcript, page 66, he noted that basically what she's doing now is making the final answer to the final question that should have been asked of her at trial, and explaining to the jury how this isn't really a complicated case. And so it's coming out in a way that's understandable, and that's what the Dillon case was talking about. The person hired an expert. You just can't hire an expert. You have to know what to do with them. And when we're dealing with the standards of review here, is there anything that shows that a mistake has been made that the judge made about what he read in the transcripts and the testimony he had at the habeas hearing? And it's not there. You had testimony, and state didn't put on any witnesses, and so he had what he had, and he indicated that we had sustained our burden at this point. But now it's their burden to show that the findings are clearly wrong, that that mistake has been made. And I don't think you can with the evidence that you've got in front of you. And then once that is done, are his conclusions warranted by the findings? But I really want to... Yes.
And who has the burden on that question? If I were to concede, or if this court concedes, that mm-hmm. there are errors made, that Judge Hoffman's findings are not erroneous, mm-hmm. then the question becomes, what impact did that have on the potential outcome of trial? Who has the burden to convince this court whether there was or was not an impact by these errors?
We had that impact at the habeas proceeding. They've got the impact to show that was wrong now. It's established in the record now that there were errors. So they've got to show that there is enough problems with that you would be convinced that a mistake has been made. I don't think you can be convinced that a mistake has been made. And then the next step is, if those findings are okay, are the legal conclusions warranted in light of those findings? And I really want to get to this point where opposing counsel had said, we're just looking at transcripts here. Well, there's another part of it where there's more than just the habeas court looking at transcripts. There's a small but notable quote in this case. The defendant made exculpatory statements and denied harming the child. That's not something I wrote. That isn't necessarily what the habeas court wrote, although it's in his findings. But that, it can be found in finding of fact number 32, not from the habeas court, but from the trial court's finding of fact. So someone who is there in the initial part of the case, when they're looking at this from the motion to suppress case, noted that the statements on those videos were exculpatory. And
how is that? Go ahead.
Counsel, I'm trying to get to the question of prejudice here.
Mm-hmm.
After the jury saw Exhibit 15, which was about an hour and some minutes of mm-hmm. of the interview in which Mr. Ellie denied harming the child,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Ellie then shortly thereafter took the stand and directly testified that he denied harming the child, and that he had done no injury to the child. So how is this alleged error prejudicial to Mr. Ellie when an hour of the interviews was shown to the jury and he testified himself?
Because a shortened video doesn't show how long he endured. His position was that he was innocent, that he didn't do anything. And yeah, you have the trial testimony, but he's also sitting there for a long time, putting up with a lot of very debasing questions. And the idea is, if you can see how long he went through that, how long is he just sitting in the room? Is he sitting in the room and an alarm's going off on the side? Should that part get edited out? Or should that whole experience be presented to the jury? And let's take a look at what he had to endure. What was taken out? Finding of fact 24. What does your religion say about telling the truth? What religion, you might ask? What kind of Muslim would be in an unmarried relationship with the child's mother? And when you are sleeping in bed with the child's mother, are you looking for your own children? Now, that's some brutal stuff. But consider, not just for the offensive content, but sort of use those tactics thinking Ali would crumble. And he didn't. The jury didn't get to see him not crumble when he was being hit with the heavy stuff. That would convince a jury that he was innocent. Well, he doesn't have to be, they have to prove that he's innocent, but that would sure go a long ways to doing that.
Isn't there a measure of speculation involved in that presumption, counsel?
I don't think so, because we've got findings of fact from, that's the thing is, I'm the appellee here. You have findings of fact and conclusions of law that are backing our position up. So, you don't have to go do, like, I had the burden of proof before, but I don't have it now. It's their burden to show that that was somehow wrong. It was in some way that you have some sort of conviction that a mistake has been made. When you look at the videos, you don't have that conviction. And I also, getting into another issue, I kind of wonder if that issue is even before you have jurisdiction, whether or not the findings are clearly wrong. Because when you look at the certified issue, it only talks about whether or not he had ineffective assistance of counsel at trial. I think that is phrased, and the state made that, proposed that issue. I think the way that it's phrased, you're only looking at whether or not the findings that are there are lead you to the conclusions. So I don't think you can challenge those findings, because there's been a string of cases where the certificate of probable causes that have been presented to this court haven't been enough to cover all issues the parties thought it might have. And the Harris versus Fluke case is an example. In that case, there was a confrontation clause issue that was in the case. The questions at the end of the certificate only addressed res judicata. The court said, you can't get into that. Even though in that case, you know, the confrontation clause issue was still in the body of the certificate, it wasn't in the questions. So be it. If that's the way it is, then you should be limited. They should be limited to that same question too. Why do they get a pass when they present the motion for certificate of probable cause, but petitioners don't? There's no reason for that. The statute dealing with appeals from habeas court in section 18.1 talks about parties. The petitioner has to jump through all these hoops. It says the parties. So I think you're just looking at taking the findings as is. And, I mean, is there any reason to even think that the oppo of an issue isn't decided in the petitioner's favor? Because Smith, when you read her in the transcript, says things of, well, I thought she wasn't going to be unavailable or might be unavailable. Oppo says, yeah, I was available. If they asked me, I would have been there. Jacob says, oh, yeah, we probably should have called her back. There's that other testimony, too, that goes into it. But you don't have to worry about any of that. because you only have to look at whether or not the legal determination by the habeas court.
The state led with the argument that it was bringing a challenge that the court improperly applied the law, the legal standard. So this it didn't appear that their challenge related to purely erroneous factual findings.
Which is right. So we don't have to get into the argument of whether or not Oppoven was available. Habeas court says she was. It was. We don't have to get into whether or not the discovery error where counsel did not give over a video that was used to an expert witness was a bad move in this case. Is that ever a reasonable trial strategy when you've got reciprocal discovery? You're not going to give over all the stuff? How are future cases going to be now? Where you can just kind of kick back and just, hey, maybe no one will notice. So those findings are locked in, I would submit, with the way that they framed
the
issue.
Time's up, Mr. Cady.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Templer, you may proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm happy to answer whatever further questions the court has. Otherwise, I just have a couple points I want to make. First and foremost, there at the end, Mr. Cady was bringing up this court's jurisdiction in this case. This court's already rejected that. He filed a motion after Judge Hoffman issued the certificate of probable cause challenging the jurisdiction. This court denied that and let the appeal proceed. So I think that's definitive in that sense. Justice Devaney, to go back to your question where you were asking about whether Judge Hoffman not referencing back to whether the decisions made by Smith and Jacobs were reasonable, I think there's a reason for that. His decision was outcome determinative, and I think that's evidenced by his emails where he directed Mr. Cady to decide whether he wanted to add the video issue into his petition. And then when the motions hearing came up, where Mr. Cady got to argue of why he should be allowed to bring that up, Judge Hoffman recognized that he couldn't Monday morning quarterback the strategic decisions of trial counsel. But then that's exactly what he did and went on to talk about how they should have called different plays with these videos. They could have played the video and hired an expert on psychology to talk about how people respond to police interrogations. That's fine, that's one strategy. But Smith and Jacobs followed an equally reasonable strategy in trying to prohibit as much of the videos from coming into evidence as possible and to rely on the witnesses to show what Allie was saying fit their defense and that the jury should have found him not guilty. At the end of the day, they got two acquittals on the most serious charges. And Ms. Smith even said when questioned by counsel at the habeas hearing, there's a lot I would have done different in this case, but there's a lot I would have done the exact same because we got those acquittals. That's why we cannot use hindsight to go back and look at what trial counsel did. We have to give them the benefit, and we have to rely on those standards and presumptions that they acted reasonably. There was nothing shown here that their actions were unreasonable, and there was nothing shown here that Allie was denied his right to a fair trial. So we'd ask that this court reverse the habeas court's determinations and reinstate Allie's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Templer.